Welcome to Go Ask Allie, a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio.
Don't think that there's some one soulmate. It's not like there's one.
Although Bon Jovi is my soulmate.
There's always exceptions.
Are you saying that gossiping is the same as if I'm picking lice out of your scalp and eating it?
Well, you've done both. So what do you think?
I don't want to give her too much. I don't like her to come in with an inflated head.
So we won't mention the Golden Globe.
After all we've been through, we deserve an orgasm, sis.
Honey,
we deserve.
I know.
Okay, welcome to Go Ask Allie. I am Allie Wentworth. And this season, I'm digging into everything I can get my hands on. I'm peeling back the layers and I'm getting dirty. I mean, like really dirty, like sexy dirty. Because I'm talking to a renowned sex expert about how we're all faring coming out of this pandemic. How did everyone do? My gosh, did your sex life survive during the pandemic? Are you having safer sex now that you have condoms and masks as the world opens up? I'm very lucky to say that during the pandemic, my husband and I continued to have great sex. And not so much for some of the people I know. I have friends that got divorced during the pandemic. I have friends that met people during the pandemic. I have friends that became closer to their vibrator during the pandemic. So everybody had very different experiences sexually. Listen, there's so much to cover when it comes to human sexuality. It is an endless wonder to me. So nobody better than Dan Savage to talk about all things SEX. Dan Savage, he's a columnist, podcaster, and author. His syndicated Savage Love sex advice column has been running for 30 years. He became one of the original podcasters in 2006 when he started Savage Lovecast, which is still going strong. He's published half a dozen books on sex and relationship. His newest book, Savage Love from A to Z, was just published last fall. Dan and his husband, Terry Miller, found the award-winning It Gets Better project, which offers support and hope to LGBTQ+ kids. Hello, Dan. I have a lot of questions for you, but I want to start with saying, I've been wondering during COVID, during the past couple of years, how is anybody dating? I've known some single friends who have been having relationships that they established online, but they haven't seen each other. They like have wine together, you know, this weird sort of cyber relationship. Are you hearing that too?
Yeah, early on in the pandemic, a lot of people were having virtual relationships, even having cyber sex, but dating online, I think a lot of those people have transitioned to dating in real life, in the flesh, now that people are vaccinated.
Mm-hmm.
But yeah, a lot of people who had never really given the internet a chance when it came to finding partners or dating suddenly adopted it. We're urged to adopt it by health departments because, you know,
yeah,
even though there was a pandemic raging and we were ordered to socially distance, if I may quote Woody Allen, the heart wants what the heart wants, and people still wanted that kind of connection. And I think what's often really important about dating is the affirmation, you know, the reminder that you are an object and a desirable one, as well as a human being and a smart one. And people needed that. And the internet made it possible for this pandemic to be a little different than it would have been, before the internet came along. The isolation was really much less acute, although a lot of people felt it. You know, I had friends who didn't see another living human being in the flesh for a year, but they were able to stay connected. We were socially distant, but not emotionally distant.
The silver lining about social media. But I will say I had a few friends that were dating online. And then when things opened up a little and then they met the person, it was, even though they were looking at each other, it was not what they expected. But I guess that goes hand in hand with online dating.
Yeah. Well, that's why before the pandemic, the advice was, you know, if you meet somebody online through a dating app, you know, schedule that first in-person meeting before you make a huge investment of time or emotional energy, because you can't always know like how you're going to vibe with someone in person.
Right.
That chemical spark, if that's going to be there. You can see all their pictures and their pictures can be accurate. And that first time that you meet face to face, it just might not click.
They're 3 feet shorter than you, and you didn't know. So have you heard, because I'm curious, during COVID and people finally meeting face-to-face, how big is the vaccine? How big a role does it play? Because I can only think, I've been married for 1,000 years, even before online dating existed, but I would imagine for me, it would be a big deal.
You see it on a lot of people's personal ads, vaxxed. I've been with my husband since before online dating was a thing, before the internet was a thing. But I sometimes go on just to like stay current because I do have to talk about these things with people who are dating now.
Right.
And, you know, I see so often people mentioning they're vaccinated that it's conspicuous when I feel like you need to say that you're vaxxed, that everyone should be vaxxed. And if you don't say that you're vaxxed on your dating profile, I think it's fair for people to assume you're not and to stay the fuck away from you.
I'm curious, do you know if watching porn just went through the roof during COVID?
Yeah, watching porn absolutely went through the roof during COVID. You know, social media, it's a double-edged sword. The more explicit kinds of social media are also a double-edged sword. I've always thought of the internet as kind of a hammer. You can pick it up and build something, or you can pick it up and beat someone to death.
Yeah.
One of the things I like about the internet when it comes to our sex lives is it's made it possible for people with niche sexual interests to connect with other people who share them all over the country. It's shrunk the world and made a lot of relationships happen and possible. It allows people to share pictures and videos they make of themselves. I think most of the porn that's made or shared on any given day in this country is amateur and between consenting adults, and it's lovers and friends. And that porn doesn't make it onto Pornhub, ideally, because, you know, if somebody shares something with you privately, you're not supposed to put it on Pornhub. But so much of what people are doing when they're swapping dirty pics and videos is swapping dirty pics and videos of themselves with people who want to see them.
That it's interesting you bring this up, because that is sort of a newer phenomenon, isn't it? I don't remember when I was, you know, young and single and free. I don't remember that being a thing. I didn't send my boyfriends naked, nor did I get dick pics from them.
You could only get dick etch-a-sketches then, or dick cocktail napkin drawings.
It's not the same thing.
Yeah, unless somebody had a Polaroid camera. And even then, Polaroids had to be passed around or passed from person to person. It was the phone in our pocket with the camera on it and then internet access that, you know, made showing off for each other and, you know, the tease with the visuals a part of most people's sex lives, and not just single people's sex lives. Tracy Clark Flory is a sex writer, and she wrote a piece about how she sexts all the time with her husband, and it's improved their sex life. They like flirt and swap pictures of themselves. And I think that's really, really common. And I think that's one of the benefits.
Unless somebody else gets a hand of them, right?
Unless they, you know, escape out into the wild. But I think we're reaching a kind of tipping point where everybody's going to have dirty pictures out there somewhere. There'll be less of a negative impact or consequence for a person if their dirty pictures somehow go public. Because instead of looking at someone's dirty pictures and going, oh my God, what a terrible person that they would do that. Now you look at somebody's dirty pictures and you go, well, there but for the grace of God go I. I have my own dirty pictures out there. We're all in this together.
Right. But it didn't exist when I was younger, but I feel like I lecture my girls about it because, you know, that's a big thing in the teen world. And, you know, that gets into a whole other thing. I mean, then it's like child pornography and it's sort of a scary, slippery slope with that.
It's child pornography. And there have even been prosecutions of kids who've taken pictures of themselves, which is a little fucked up.
Yeah.
We do need to warn our kids about taking and sharing photographs. Mm-hmm. We also need to get on our kids about not sharing a photo that was shared with you privately.
Yes. Yes.
Because that's the real consent violation. That's the thing that's shameful and that should be stigmatized. It makes me bananas when, you know, some girls' photos were spread around a school and that girl gets suspended. It's everybody who shared that photo who should be suspended.
100%.
Not just high school kids. Like, adults will do that too. You know, we do need to have in our back of our heads, if we take and share a photograph, a phone can be hacked. Somebody can share that photograph with someone they think they can trust who can't be trusted. Mm-hmm. You're really not in control of it anymore. The future that I'm imagining is one where, since all of us or most of us have photos online, it can't be used to socially harm anybody, any individual anymore. In the same way, finding out that somebody has used pot doesn't destroy a career anymore. Mm-hmm. And I think we're getting there with Dirty Vote, is where, oh, you've never taken one? Well, that's odd, because almost everyone has. And therefore, you know, in my idealized future, it can't do the damage that it has done to some people's lives and careers now. That's, of course, very different when someone's underage, when someone is a minor. In the same way, sexual activity can land differently when you're underage, inexperienced, not ready for it. You know, I think a 30-year-old who's shared a bunch of photographs can shrug off one of those ending up on the internet or a friend finding them in a way that a 14-year-old can't.
Yeah, I completely agree. And I liken it to when the sex tapes on VHS was a thing. You know, it's like, oh, who's making a sex tape? And that was like terrifying. And then all of a sudden, they all get leaked and you've seen them all. And, you know, this is back in the day when I was like, oh, who's this Kim Kardashian? You know, so.
Or Tommy Lee and Pamela Anderson. Remember when their sex tape got out there?
Somebody's doing a big movie about it. Yeah, but I remember that was like a really big deal. And now, you know, even that has become sort of dismissed as, ah, yeah, it's just a sex tape.
Paris Hilton is testifying before Congress about those wilderness camp boarding schools and being taken seriously, as she should be on that. And, you know, it hasn't hurt Kim Kardashian's career that her first entry in, kind of into public consciousness was because of a sex tape. And, you know, I think Pamela Anderson, after this movie comes out, is going to be, she's going to have a revival, not be like sent away in shame. And that's as it should be. You know, when you think about our sex lives, almost universally now for young people, their very first sexual experiences, tech is the medium that their first sort of, you know, used to be like your imagination or a stray porn mag, if you can get your hands on one, you know, or the Sears catalog underwear section, you know, 80 years ago. And now, like, so many people's first sexual experiences are sitting in front of computers or looking at phones. And those are interactive devices. So you can, you're not just like taking it in, you can also put it out there. And it makes a kind of sense that so many people have incorporated technology into their sexual expression, into their sex lives, almost effortlessly, because people who are 30 now or 25 now had their first iPhones, which are really porn production studios, in their pockets when they were teenagers, and they've always been with them. And, you know, a computer or a phone isn't just for communicating or texting or reading Twitter, it's also for looking at porn, learning about sex, reading, connecting, finding sex partners. It's a porn production studio. It's a singles bar. It's really everything. And so that people are filming themselves having sex and in a kind of effortless, unselfconscious way totally makes sense. We should have seen this coming.
I'm looking at your face and you're smiling. So you approve of this. Do you think it's a great thing?
I think it's a thing.
It's a thing. Yeah.
It can, you know, it's like I said, it's a hammer. You can build something or destroy something with it.
Right.
The video that you made today and shared with your lover, relationships go south. Sometimes you were with somebody and they become a vindictive ex and they have these things that they could, you know, send to your mom and your coworkers. And that has happened to men and women.
Do you have callers that have called in about that?
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, lots of revenge porn stories. Yeah.
And I'm happy to say now that, like, there are revenge porn statutes in, I think, 30 states more. When I first started talking about this issue on my podcast, there were no revenge porn statutes anywhere. It was not a crime to, you know, if you had someone's pictures or video, to email it to everyone at their workplace. It was not a crime. Mm-hmm. Now it's a crime, and people have been prosecuted, and it's shifted some of the, hopefully, stigma and shame and consequences onto the shoulders of people who should be stigmatized and face consequences for this kind of behavior. Not the person who took a picture of her tits or his dick and sent it to somebody who wanted to see the tits or the dick.
Right.
But the person who then tried to destroy someone's life with that picture.
Well, I mean, you know, to me, social media is just the Wild West. And so I'm happy to hear there are laws about revenge porn. There's a lot more to come after this short break. Welcome back. You know, we're coming out of COVID. It's a little bit safer to be out and about. I would imagine your callers and some of the things you're dealing with on your podcast are a little shifted now. What are some of the things that you're hearing from people, or concerns, or great things even?
The great thing is, you know, people are anxious to get out there.
Mm-hmm.
Right before the pandemic hit, there was a lot of writing and talking about a sex recession, that younger people were having less sex.
Or waiting till they were older, right?
Or waiting till they were older. And, you know, if you're as old as I am, you remember when the moral panic was young people having too much sex.
Mm-hmm.
And rainbow parties and teen pregnancies and high STI rates among young people.
I got to ask you, what is a rainbow party?
It was bullshit. It was this thing that ran around in the 90s that high school students were all getting together and the girls were putting on different shades of lipstick. And then the boys on their penises were collecting rings until their penises looked like rainbows. Okay. And that's just not how dicks work or lips work or lipstick works. And yet people believe this was a thing.
A rainbow party. Okay.
Now the concern is like people aren't having sex. I think a lot of people are getting back out there. Unfortunately, people are getting back out there and not being safe. We are seeing a huge explosion in the last 6 months in STI rates. So people who did the right thing and took care to be safe from COVID are running out of the house now that they're vaccinated and there's some degree of normalcy, and being cavalier, taking risks around STIs.
Isn't syphilis on the rise right now?
Yeah, syphilis is on the rise, gonorrhea, chlamydia, all on the rise. And we may see when we can finally have the data for this year that STI rates are higher in the United States. That's the projection, higher now than they have ever been in history. That's a problem. And that's in a circumstance where more people are waiting, where there's a bit of a sex recession. There are lots of people, particularly young men, who've never had a sex partner. And yet we are seeing this often driven by the gay male community boom in STIs.
So that because they feel they're vaccinated, so the imminent death threat or imminent health concern is taken care of, and so they're not really thinking about their sexual health?
Yeah, and people engage in a little bit of magical thinking. Like, I did the right thing during COVID, therefore, like, the universe owes me this risk. You know, I don't want to have to wear a condom because I wore a mask. I shouldn't have to wear a condom because I wore a mask. People engage in a lot of magical thinking when they're horny, not just people with penises, people without penises too, engage in a lot of magical thinking and rationalizations. One more thing about STIs, it's sort of a tragedy. I had a call, and I talked about this with an epidemiologist on my show, that if we were all going to be locked in, remember early in the pandemic when we thought it'd be 2 months, 3 months?
Mm-hmm.
Everyone who'd been exposed to an STI, their symptoms would appear. And if everybody got treated during lockdown, we could eradicate not HIV, not HPV.
Right.
And not herpes, because they persist in our bodies, but chlamydia, syphilis, and gonorrhea.
Wow.
If like nobody touched anybody for 3 months and then everybody who was symptomatic got treated, then when we all got back out there, there would be no syphilis, gonorrhea, or chlamydia, but it did not work out that way.
Well, I don't remember anyone telling everybody to do that. That would have been a great idea. Where were you, Dan?
I talked about it on my show. The problem is that like people don't have access to healthcare. Like,
yes.
You know, we were providing people with free COVID screenings, providing people with free vaccines when they came out, not charging people if they wound up in the hospital for COVID. But if, you know, you don't have access to a primary care physician and you don't have enough money because you're broke and unemployed and at home during lockdown to pay for the meds, you know, a lot of people just tough out a sexually transmitted infection and didn't get treated. And not everybody, of course, stayed in during lockdown.
Yes. Certainly during lockdown, when you see the beach parties in Florida and stuff, that seemed like a big festival of STDs. So I have a question for you. With orgies, what happens if you go to an orgy? I'm asking for a friend. If you go to an orgy and there's a bunch of people there and somebody's not vaccinated.
You know, if there's one unvaccinated person at an event, the risk for the vaccinated is low. The risk really is for the unvaccinated people. They're dying at, what is it, 9-10 times the rate of the vaccinated. Our hospitals that are, you know, not as overwhelmed now as they were a month or two ago, but still mobbed. It's the unvaccinated.
Yep.
So one unvaccinated person managing to get into your orgy, all right, whatever. The question I keep getting isn't about orgies, it's about weddings.
Oh, I thought the two went hand in hand. Well, I mean, that'd be a fun wedding.
Ideally, I think so. I don't think getting married should be the end of sexual adventure and pleasure.
Right.
I think people should be able to go to the occasional orgy or sex party after they're married. I certainly have with my husband.
Yeah.
The question I get, it's the, you know, I'm going home to a wedding and they're not vaccinated, the bride and groom, and they're not requiring anyone to be vaccinated. And they're inviting old people in the family to attend. And I'm vaccinated and I don't want to go.
Right.
Because, you know, even if you're vaxxed, you can still get infected.
Absolutely.
Breakthrough cases like Colin Powell.
Perfect example. So you're a big LGBTQ activist. And one of the things that I was reading and talking to people about during COVID was how many gay and trans kids were then in lockdown with people that didn't accept who they were. And it was incredibly difficult for them and their mental health.
Yeah.
So did you find when you spoke to a lot of people from, especially younger people in that community, that was the case?
Yeah. I mean, the world is different now. When I came out when I was a teenager, a rare case for gay men of my generation, and then I came out in high school. It was more common for gay men of my generation to come out in college or after college. And the assumption then, if you were gay and a teenager and out, was that your family was hostile. The assumption now is like, you know, your family is probably in your corner. And we've seen that again and again with families, even in like red states, defending their queer children in a way that would have blown our minds in the 80s. That said, it's an often unacknowledged fact in the lives of a lot of queer young people that the worst bullying they face isn't at school, it's at home.
Right.
And for a lot of young queer kids, school is the refuge and home is the minefield. And I heard from kids, I heard from teenagers who no longer could go to the GSA, who no longer could go to school and not feel policed by bullying parents or scrutinized by hostile siblings about their gender presentation or their sexual orientation. And that was very, very stressful. That said, have you ever heard of PFLAG, Parents and Friends of Lesbians and Gays?
Mm-hmm.
When I was, you know, in the early 80s, when PFLAG would come up the street, everyone would lose it at the Pride Parade. Everyone would be bawling because so many of us at the Pride Parade, watching it go by, didn't have parents who loved us. A lot of us were estranged from our parents. And to see parents marching in the Pride Parade, and to sometimes, you know, I'm going to cry talking about it.
I'm going to cry listening.
Gay men and lesbians, like, be hugged by a parent, and not even their parent, and lose it. God bless PFLAG, and they've done such great and important work. It doesn't have the same emotional impact when PFLAG walks up the street in the Pride Parade. Now, everyone is deliriously happy to see them. Is that as devastating because it's no longer the default expectation that a gay person who's out has a terrible relationship with their parents or that our parents don't love us? It's almost shocking now when you hear from a gay person in the West, in the United States, whose parents, even if they had a bad reaction at first, have not yet come around and don't love and accept them. And that's what we fought for. We want to live in a world where the expectation is that you will have the love and support of your family, if not immediately, hopefully shortly after you come out.
Right.
The social norms and expectations have changed.
Yeah.
It's a bitter irony that some parents rejected their gay kids because they thought that's what they had to do to be good people, because they didn't want to be judged or shamed for accepting their gay kids. You know, 40 years ago, what would the neighbors think if I was okay about my kid being gay? So I'm going to not be okay about it, lest I be judged. Now people are judged when they don't accept their gay kids. And thank God, and they should be.
Exactly.
But it you know, I have a friend who's 30, who's such a lovely person. And, you know, his father was dying and he was the one who went home and took care of his father. And his dad was very hostile about him being gay, kind of came around. But his mom, even after his father's death, his mom is still like, you're going to hell and you need to repent and you need to stop this. He was the one who went home. He was the one who was there for his parents as his father died. And his mother is still like bullying him.
Wow.
It affects him in a way that, you know.
Of course. How could it not? Yeah.
The only comparison is like, you know, transracial adoptions. Mixed race kids sometimes feel like they have a racist parent. And it is devastating.
Can't even imagine.
To be gay or trans or bi and have a parent who is the worst bully in your life and the one you can't escape and the one whose approval on some level you always crave and whose the withdrawal of their love you'll always feel.
Right. And be punished by.
And yeah, be wounded by. Yeah. I sometimes get in trouble with some people in the gay community because I will tell, or the LGBT community, I will tell, you know, gay kids who want to come out to wait. I'm the one who will tell a 15-year-old gay boy that coming out is not the end of all of your troubles. It's the beginning of new troubles. And if your parents are really hostile, 40% of homeless kids, homeless minors, are LGBT kids who were kicked out or thrown out after they came out. And they're only like 3-4% of the population. So they're disproportionately represented among homeless youth. And so, my God, if you're 15 and you think your parents might throw you out on the street, maybe you should wait. You know, their parents taught them not to lie. And now they're having to lie to their parents.
Right.
And I've told kids, like, that's a lie you tell your parents under duress. And it's their fault you have to tell that lie. And you shouldn't feel guilty about it. So if you have to lie to your parents that they're paying for your college and they'll withdraw that support, if you tell them you're gay, don't tell them you're gay till you got your first job. Then tell them you're gay.
Right. Till you're more independent.
Yeah. And it's on them that you couldn't be honest with them, not on you. It's their failing, not yours.
Right. We're going to take a short break and we'll be right back. And we're back. Did you find that a lot of people kind of lost their libido during COVID?
Justin Leigh Miller, who's a sex researcher and writer, a host of the Sex and Psychology podcast at Kinsey Institute, they've been tracking it. They've been gathering data throughout the pandemic. The data is a little maddening in how sort of right down the middle it falls. Roughly half of people during the pandemic saw their libidos tank. Roughly half of people during the pandemic saw their libidos just skyrocket.
That's so interesting. And do they know why?
No, it's just like some people reacted to the stress and the isolation by just being super horny, and some people reacted to it by shutting down sexually.
Right.
You know, that feeling of confinement for some people, like to have to sit with your thoughts or sit alone in your home, their thoughts go to sex and they can feel it. The real problem was like everyone whose libido tanked wasn't necessarily in a relationship with someone else whose libido tanked. And some people were in mixed tanked relationships.
Right.
Like mine tanked, yours didn't. My tank, yours skyrocketed. Now what do we do? Now you're super frustrated or I'm having to do things I don't want to do.
Yeah, exactly. It's much more complicated than the statistics that said, you know, a lot of people ended up getting divorced or separating or breaking up because they were confined together and it wasn't working. Some people thrived with it. But I would imagine sexually, I mean, to get both trains on the same track are a little bit difficult. I mean, I can only speak for myself. I mean, thank God I have a healthy sex life with my husband. But there were moments during lockdown with my dark roots coming in and I've just packed on 10 pounds because I'm living for Ben and Jerry's at night. And I just didn't feel sexual because my own health wasn't thriving. I would imagine, like you said, that it's very hard to get you and your partner kind of symbiotic anyway.
Yeah, not during a pandemic, it's hard to be on the same page all the time. And you have to seize those opportunities when they come. I'm a big proponent of maintenance sex. I'm a big proponent of assisted masturbation. Sometimes you know...
What's maintenance sex?
You have sex with your partner because they want to have sex.
Okay.
It's not like perhaps the most off the wall or energetic or athletic sex you might have, mm-hmm. but you're just like...
You're being a good partner.
You're being a good partner. And this gets dicey when you talk about sort of men and women.
I was going to say, every woman, every female audience person right now is going, oh, girl, I know what that is.
Yeah, yeah. You know, women are socialized to defer to men and not mm-hmm. say no to men. And... You know, a lot of the standard advice is now you should never have sex that you don't want to have. Well, there are sometimes you might want to have sex, but not because you want to have sex. There's sometimes you might want to have sex to meet your partner's needs, to maintain the relationship, or, you know, the expectation that your partner will do the same for you if you're horny and they're not. I think it's really important in sexually exclusive relationships that you make an effort.
Yep, I agree with you 100%. I think there are times for me where I feel like, yeah, he's in a sexy mood, and I don't want to be the one in the turtleneck sweater nightgown going like, don't touch me, don't look at me. And, you know, I do it for him. But there's a lot of this wave of empowerment where people say, like, only when I want, on my terms. And I think that that just hurts the relationship in the long run.
I think it does hurt the relationship in the long run. And there's something you can get out of sex other than sex. Mm-hmm. Intimacy, connection, release. And often,
yes,
when you're having maintenance sex, you catch a groove and suddenly you're having sex that you want to have too.
Yes.
And you deny yourself all of those opportunities to like catch that groove and suddenly be into it and really glad your partner instigated and you went there.
Mm-hmm.
The other thing that I often suggest to people besides maintenance sex, you know, I say this to straight guys all the time. If every time you said yes to sex, your ass got fucked, you'd say yes probably less often than you might otherwise. Then, you know, penetration can be a high bar for the penetratee sometimes.
Right.
So be willing to like mutual masturbation, light oral, rolling around. You know, sometimes maintenance sex isn't intercourse. Sometimes maintenance sex is what I like to call assisted masturbation. And if you're open to that and you don't guilt your partner about it or treat it like a sad consolation prize, but as actual sex, you'll have more and better.
Yes. And hence a stronger relationship. Before I let you go and have sex, I'm going to go have a sandwich. Tell me this, for people that sort of got through the pandemic with a pretty good sexual relationship, for people that are now sort of crawling out from under the rocks and looking for other sexual partners, what kind of advice can you give us now?
Well, if you've been not very sexually active throughout the pandemic, get tested before you get out there. Get an STI screening. You know, sometimes people can have gonorrhea in their throat, they can have gonorrhea in their rear end, and they don't have a lot of symptoms. And a syphilis sore can be very subtle, you know, and then it goes away and you stop thinking about it, but you have syphilis and you can be infectious. So if you haven't been screened in a while, get screened. And if you do have something, get treated before you get out there. But I think my only other piece of advice is, one of the things we should take away from the pandemic, all of us, is something that a lot of gay men took away from the HIV epidemic. Life is short and precious. You don't have as much time to waste as you think. So ask for what you want and go look for what you want and find somebody who you're what they want, and the things that you want to do are the things that they want to do. I'm always in the position of telling people to kind of embrace rejection. You know, people will not be fully who they are with somebody because they're afraid of being rejected. They won't ask for what they want because, like, then what if that person doesn't want that and they reject me? Well, if they don't want what you want, then you're not a match and it's going to end eventually anyway.
Right.
So put it out there in a, you know, an emotionally intelligent and reasonable way. You don't like blurt out all your kinks in the first date, but like lay that out there.
Right.
And if they're not into you,
bye-bye.
Yeah, put it out there. Don't fear rejection. Rejection's your friend, as painful as rejection is, because the sooner somebody that's not right for you rejects you, the sooner you land in the bed, in the lap, and the life of someone who's right for you. Not perfect. There's no perfect. There's no the one. There's only the 0.64 that you round up to the one. But rejection gets you to that person faster.
And what about people that have been in long-term relationships? Any advice for them now?
Don't pull the plug. You know, this was the pandemic and all the time we had to spend with our partners. That's not normal. And some people are over-determining and saying, well, because I couldn't be with this person locked in a one-bedroom apartment in Manhattan 24 hours a day, 7 days a week for months on end, obviously this isn't the right person for me. No, no, no. Time away is good, and that will come back now into your life. Don't look at your partner and say, because I can't be with you 24 hours a day, I shouldn't be with you at all. Look at your partner and say, well, we'll get back to that time away that we all need from our partners.
Yeah. It was really an unprecedented time that we've all been through.
Yeah.
And, you know, we underestimate the anxiety and so many of the other factors that played into it, which make it hard for yourself, for your partner, for everything. for sex, for love?
You have to make sure you're making a distinction between I can't stand this person and, you know, the being with them all the time just really made me face that and be honest with myself about it. Or I've spent so much time with this person that I can't stand it. I can't stand spending so much time with one person. You know, we need other friends. We need work colleagues. We need to leave the house and move through the day and then be excited to see somebody.
Right.
You know, when it comes to sex and relationship advice, literally every cliche applies. Absence makes the heart grow fonder.
Yeah. I mean, believe me, nothing turns me on more than when my husband does the dishes. So I get it. So, Dan, I like to turn the tables now and have you ask me a question, anything you want. Go ask Allie.
How do you feel about constitutional monarchy as a political system?
No, here's one that I've never got before. How do I feel about monarchy? I'm not a believer in monarchy. I'm much more pro-democracy, although I love the crown. And I love the clothes. I don't think monarchy works. Why? What do you think of it?
I'm not for monarchy when you're talking about like the Sultan of Brunei or Saudi Arabia.
Right.
But Denmark, Norway, Sweden, Spain, a lot of like liberal progressive paradise, the Netherlands, mm-hmm. are monarchies. And I really sometimes, particularly, you know, having observed American politics over the last entirety of my life, I think it's attractive, and I think we should invite Harry and Meghan to become king and queen of America.
Oh, wow. I was going to say the problem with our country is we don't have a royal family. I was going to say George and Amal Clooney, but I guess if you want. That's the problem. We'd have to elect them. Like, yeah. Who's the person that goes, okay, here's our new monarchy?
I mean, when Norway got their king and queen only 100 years ago, it was through referendum. Not that they rule. They're just constitutional monarchs like the Queen of England. And I'm kind of a fan. I think there's something to it.
We should call Meghan and see if she's into it.
Or my husband. He could be Queen of America.
Great.
I think he'd be good at it.
All right. Well, send me a picture of him with a crown and a robe and I'll we'll put it on social media and get people to vote. It'll be a reality show.
Yep.
Dan Savage, thank you very much for talking to me about all these things.
My pleasure.
Well, we covered a lot, but there, I think when it comes to sex, there's, you know, you could just talk forever. There are so many different channels we could go because sex is an all-consuming subject. But it seems, you know, I sort of thought that during the pandemic, people were, you know, sitting alone in their houses reading Sylvia Plath. But it's great to hear that there was a silver lining during the pandemic when it came to social media and people's sexuality, that people were able to connect. You know, I think when it comes to sex, where there's a will, there's a way, and people will find ways to connect. And the most important thing is I learned what a rainbow party was. God help me. Anyway, Dan Savage is always incredible to talk to about all things sex. And now I'm going to stretch, take a hot bath, and go jump on my husband. Thank you for listening to Go Ask Allie. I hope you blushed a little bit. I did. Be sure to subscribe, rate, and review the podcast and follow me on social media, on Twitter at Allie E. Wentworth and on Instagram at The Real Allie Wentworth. Now, if you'd like to ask me a question or suggest a guest or a topic to dig into, I would love to hear from you. And there's a whole bunch of ways to do that. You can call me or text me at 323-364-6356, or you can email a voice memo right from your phone to goaskalliepodcast@gmail.com. If you leave a question, you never know, you may hear it on Go Ask Allie. Go Ask Allie is a production of Shondaland Audio in partnership with iHeartRadio. For more podcasts from Shondaland Audio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.